This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Once again, and not for the last time, follow the economic money, people. It explains a lot. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Risdahl. It is Thursday today, the 17th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Let's start with China today, shall we? It's been a while since we've checked in on the state of the world's most significant economic relationship. Strained is a good word to use, what with the still ongoing trade war and the Trump administration's pushback against Chinese technology, see also TikTok. And we've got some new numbers that help us quantify the extent of that strain. Long-term investment between the two countries, things like new factories and putting money into startups, is at a 9-year low. Marketplace's Scott Tong has the lay of the economic land.
The point of U.S. tariffs is to make manufacturing in China too expensive and get companies to leave. Some have, but there's little evidence factories are coming to the U.S., according to the report. It was co-written by the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations. Commission President Stephen Orlins says the jobs that left China went elsewhere.
So Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia, Sri Lanka, other places, but it did not bring manufacturing back to the United States.
Chinese investment in the U.S. is also down because of the pandemic recession and because Washington is suspicious of Chinese companies like TikTok. And that's put pressure on Beijing to retaliate against foreign companies in China. Thilo Hanneman is with the Rhodium Group, which co-authored the report.
Foreign companies may be hesitant to further deepen their footprint inside of China. They might diversify away from their Chinese manufacturing bases over the next couple of years.
That's especially true in strategically important sectors like semiconductors. But he expects U.S.-China investment to continue in other areas, Disney opening theme parks in China, or Chinese clothing factories shipping their products here. To Hanneman, this matters in the big picture.
We know from history that two-way trade and investment and integration decreases the risk of conflict. If China really is isolated as a country, one of the biggest risks for all of us will be higher risk of a serious military confrontation.
In the first half of 2020, U.S. long-term investments in China fell 31%. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We spend a whole lot of time on this program looking at numbers that tell us something about us and this economy that we live in. And every now and then, exactly what those numbers measure and how they measure it gets a bit of a tweak to give us a better picture of what's going on. Case in point, the latest data from the Census Bureau, in which they noted a change in the way they look at households, adding an option for people to specify whether their relationship, assuming they're in one, whether it was a same-sex marriage or partnership. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more on that change.
In 2019, the census estimates there were nearly a million same-sex households in the U.S. About 58% included married couples, the rest unmarried partners. Sherita Gruberg, who studies LGBTQ issues at the Center for American Progress, says this new data doesn't capture all kinds of relationships, some trans or bisexual couples, for example, but it's still good to have.
Federal data is incredibly important for how Congress decides to allocate money for programs.
For instance, says Rose Kreider, a family demographer at the Census Bureau.
Federal agencies that have programs that they administer based on marital status need this information in order to accurately predict who's going to be using certain programs.
The census found that same-sex couples participate in the labor force at a higher rate than opposite-sex couples, almost 85% compared to just over 80%. One possible reason?
LGBTQ folks suffer from an income gap as compared to their heterosexual cisgendered peers.
Spencer Watson runs the Center for LGBTQ Economic Advancement and Research.
the higher labor force participation is likely reflecting the fact that they have to work more in order to make comparable amount of earnings.
The new information in the survey could help educate employers, says Kristen Brody, policy director of the Brookings Institution's Hamilton Project.
So this gives them that information without people having to have conversations that they may or may not want to have at work.
And that, says Brody, can help inform training around diversity and inclusion. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, varying degrees of not so great. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One of the many things that's weird about this coronavirus economy is how it's hitting some industries real hard, some industries almost not at all, and then some industries real hard at first, but now much less so. Housing falls into that last category, so we have called a mortgage broker here in L.A. who we know. Vivian Geller is a partner at Pacific Trust Group. Vivian, it's good to have you back on.
Hi, Kai. Thanks for having me back on.
So what a difference 6 months make, right? We talked to you in March at the beginning of all this, and suffice it to say, it was not looking great in real estate and mortgages, open houses being canceled, all of that stuff. How's it been?
It's been crazy, Kai. Yeah, it's definitely been a crazy last 6 months. And quite honestly, it's gone in a totally different direction than I would have anticipated. The market's completely picked up. We're at, you know, record lows in interest rates, which is fueling the real estate market. And in fact, it's been busier than ever.
Who is buying houses now? Because it seems to me that makes a difference, right?
Yeah, pretty much it's, you know, we're seeing borrowers that are salaried, well-prepared to buy houses. It's a little more difficult for self-employed borrowers right now because the banks are doing an extra level of due diligence to make sure that these self-employed borrowers qualify for the loans. You know, they're asking for business bank statements, and they want to see those deposits going into the business. So it's been tough for those that are self-employed, but if you're salaried and you have, you know, a W-2 job, It's not so bad.
The problem, of course, is that so many people are self-employed or in the gig economy, and I imagine you must have conversations with your would-be clients to say, I'm sorry, we can't do it.
Oh, yeah, definitely, especially here in Los Angeles where we have, you know, a huge population that's self-employed. It makes it really hard, especially people in production, you know, that are not working right now. So it's been very difficult for both refinances and for purchases. I basically had to tell them that we're just going to have to wait until work picks back up for them.
Well, let's get to the until part, right? Because there's a lot wrapped up in that phrase. As you know, Jay Powell said yesterday, interest rates are going to be low as far as the eye can see. The pandemic is still in control of this economy. Suss out your business for me for the next, I don't know, like year, 18 months?
Yeah, I think it's going to continue to be really busy. As long as interest rates stay low, it's going to be very, very busy. The banks are probably going to continue to make it a little tough for self-employed borrowers. Some banks have actually already said that the self-employed borrowers have to bring larger down payments in to qualify. So it may be difficult for those borrowers, but the low interest rates are going to continue to fuel the real estate market, no question.
With the caveat here that you are in Los Angeles, a major metropolitan area, I'm sure you have colleagues in other parts of the country. What are you seeing of this phenomenon that we keep hearing about of people ditching big cities and saying, you know what, I can work from anywhere. I don't have to be here where real estate is high. I'm going to move to Ottumwa, Iowa.
Absolutely true. We've seen so many clients here move to Palm Springs and Santa Barbara. So yes, we're seeing a lot of that, but we're seeing that happen. San Francisco, you know, New York, Los Angeles, people are just moving to where they want to be, not necessarily in a big city.
Vivian Geller, she's at the Pacific Trust Group here in LA. Vivian, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Kai. Thanks so much.
Hey, how you feeling? I mean, physically, right? Because we're all stressed and uneasy mentally. But you feeling fit? Maybe less fit than you'd like? About good? I'm asking because gyms, big and small, aren't feeling all that great. Yes, some have been very tentatively reopening in some states. Others have closed up forever. As all the while, fitness migrates to online apps and communities. Marketplace's Jasmine Garz is on the fitness desk today.
Big names in the gym club game have already gone bankrupt, like 24 Hour Fitness, Gold's Gym, and New York Sports Club's parent company. Meanwhile, for at-home fitness apps offering classes and communities, sales are skyrocketing. This week, Apple joined the fray with its subscription service, offering yoga and running for about $10 a month, a fraction of what most people pay for gyms.
Workout, trainer, time, music.
Apple enters a crowded field. Peloton, Nike, Adidas, and a bunch of other tech and athletic brands are already there. The online fitness industry is projected to grow by 20% over the next 7 years. Joe Favorito is a sports marketing consultant and professor at Columbia University.
I think anyone who's in the fitness business that doesn't have some kind of online component right now and is trying to look back to where we were on March 13th is going to be in a lot of trouble.
That includes small studios. Yoga instructor Jessica Sandu's students followed her onto Zoom. She charges about $120 for private sessions. She says business is better than ever.
I've been very financially okay. I've never actually been able to save money as I have now.
In order for brick-and-mortar gyms to muscle their way out of this crisis, they may need to go hybrid, like Equinox. The high-end gym launched its online fitness app in mid-March. For gyms, it's time to level up or wipe out. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Coming up,
all the prices are increasing at the moment.
Climate change is expensive, y'all. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials finished things down 130 points today, 0.4%, 27,901. The NASDAQ down 140 points, 1.2%, 10,910. The S&P 500 gave back 28 points, 0.8%, finished at 3,357. Talking real estate as we were, 2.87% is the number. The average interest rate on a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage in the United States as of today, that's according to Freddie Mac. 1 year ago, for those who are curious, nearly a full percentage point higher, 3.7%, 3.73 technically. So mortgage lenders, well, according to the CFPB, the top mortgage lender in America is Rocket Companies, Rocket Mortgage and Quicken Loans. Shares gave up 0.6%. Today you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Behind every successful business is a story. And some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, Listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hey, you remember that coin shortage we told you about? Not as many nickels and dimes and quarters circulating because of how the pandemic has changed our shopping habits. Do not get me started on the penny, by the way. Anyway, it's still a thing, that coin shortage. But this next story is about a surplus of currency of a sort also caused by this pandemic. We're talking about those paper tickets you can redeem for prizes at Chuck E. Cheese. The company, which filed for bankruptcy back in June, asked a bankruptcy court this week to, and this is a quote, arrange for the destruction of, and then this is a quote too, enough tickets to fill approximately 65 40-foot cargo shipping containers. So, Leslie Pappas covers bankruptcy for Bloomberg Industry Group. She wrote the story that we saw, so we got her on the phone. Leslie, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So how did it come to pass that there are however many truckloads or container loads of these tickets sitting in storage?
Well, the tickets are used to redeem prizes, obviously, and Chuck E. Cheese needs them on a regular basis. And before the pandemic, ordered many of them from suppliers based on regular business. And then COVID happened.
Right. And they are fundamentally, if you're keeping Chuck E. Cheese's books, these are basically money.
They're money. I think they're worth... A retail value is a fraction of a penny
But if I got my hands on all those truckloads and walked into my local Chuck E. Cheese, I'd be doing all right, right?
Yeah, I found that there's actually the 7 billion tickets that they're asking their suppliers to destroy would be, if you redeem those, that'd be worth $9 million worth of prizes.
$9 million worth of Chuck E. Cheese prizes. I cannot even conceive. Why does the company need the bankruptcy court to do this thing that seems to make a lot of sense from a business perspective?
Well, once a company has filed Chapter 11, they need to get the court's permission for pretty much everything. Uh-huh. I mean, they can't just do what they want. They are now a debtor in possession, and the money they spend is per a budget that's been approved by the court. So what they're actually asking to approve is not shredding of these tickets. There's actually more tickets in their own back rooms that they need to destroy. But these 7 billion tickets, they are actually asking the court to approve settlements with these vendors at a cost of $2.3 million. If they had gone ahead and let the tickets go through the supply chain, they would have paid more. And then, of course, if the tickets had fallen into the public's hands, they could redeem them for much more in prizes. So they have to go to the court to show them that, hey, this $2.3 million sounds like a lot, but really, in the grand scheme of things, we're saving money for the estate.
Right, spending money to save money for the remnants of Chuck E. Cheese. We should say, though, that there are some outfits that are still operating. So what does this say about the prospects, I guess, for Mr. Cheese and his company?
Well, the company is still looking to market itself. The bankruptcy certainly is not over. They're looking to, they're marketing the company for sale. Just because they're getting rid of the tickets doesn't mean the company is necessarily going away. And by the way, they will continue to redeem the tickets that are out there. And some of the franchisees will still be using paper tickets. But they basically, the pandemic prompted them to accelerate a plan that they sort of already had to phase these out and go to contactless e-tickets.
Right. Where does this rank on your weirdness scale of things that you've come across in bankruptcy filings, by the way?
There's a lot of weird stuff. There's a lot of weird stuff, but this is certainly one that a lot of other people are interested in, whereas normally most people don't care about the weird stuff I find.
Fair enough. Leslie Pappas covers bankruptcy for the Bloomberg Industry Group. Leslie, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much.
There's a piece of data from yesterday's retail sales report that we didn't quite have time to get into. Clothing. Sales up almost 3% July to August. Good news for professionals in the clothing business, as you will hear in today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Aaliyah Wanick, and I'm a women's wear designer and speech therapist in the Bay Area. My day-to-day before COVID would have been going to work. So I work with young adults with disabilities and going in, working a full day, coming home, maybe taking like an hour or two, you know, to myself, and then working for like 4 to 6 hours, depending on the line. And that could have been anything from sewing garments to just to anything that has to do with the business. I guess it feels a bit embarrassing to say that is what happens Monday through Friday. And then on the weekends, I kind of devote solely to the business with more time taken to myself. But I feel like I just sound like a workhorse. I don't know. The spotlight on like supporting Black-owned businesses, definitely within like the past 2 months, there's been like exponential growth with the business in a way that is really exciting, but also really crazy at the same time. When you're going along, you sewing the garments, you have another full-time job, to now all of a sudden gaining 20,000 followers, selling out multiple collections after like a day or two, it's been a pretty big adjustment. I was thinking about it. I don't know if I've really heard of people who are like, I hold 2 full-time jobs successfully for a really long time. Like, I don't know if that's possible. You know, I think the phrase or what's being said more now about me at work is like, Aaliyah's really busy. Aaliyah has a lot on her plate. And I was thinking about that the other day, and I was just like, I don't think that's necessarily fair to have people have to make that allowance about me because they know how busy I am with my clothing line. So I think for that, it's like, I really have to look at that and say like, hey, is this compromising? That's where it's like seeing how next year turns out, seeing if it's staying on this level, if there's some sort of plateau. I know in the meantime, I'm going to work as hard as I can.
Aaliyah Wanick, designing clothes and working as a speech therapist in the San Francisco Bay Area. If you would care to share the story of your economy, we would love to hear it. We truly would. Tell us over at marketplace.org. The thing about global warming is that it's global. And just as we are seeing it here with hurricanes and wildfires and derechos, they are seeing it over in the UK as well, where farmers have been dealing with months of unusually terrible weather. Wheat farmers in particular are looking at their worst harvest in a generation, yields down by as much as 40%. Marketplace's and the BBC's Justin Rollett has been out in the fields.
Rain. The sound of every farmer's nightmare come harvest time, because it's hard to get your crops in when they're wet. And even when the turbulent weather of the last couple of weeks does eventually lift, the misery won't be over. When you look at this crop, what do you see?
I'm looking at a crop that's too thin and awful.
Matt Cully grows fields of wheat in South England, and he's the chair of the UK's National Farmers Union Crop Board. He is expecting the worst harvest in the 37 years he's been farming.
Started back in October, November 2019, incredibly wet. Crops failed to get their roots down into the soil properly. And then a very, very dry spring drought. Crops weren't able to respond. Nutrient uptake was poor, which has led now to harvest poor yields. And now it's raining, we can't gather the crop in.
Matt takes me to one of the barns where he stores his grain.
And yeah, it's empty at the moment.
By this time of year, you'd normally have quite a bit of grain in.
And this, yeah, normally this would be virtually full.
And look at that, that's
incredible. That's what we've cut so far. We're looking at 30% down on our yields.
And the fear is the kind of weather Britain has seen this year could become more common. The UK Meteorological Office is saying it's expecting these extremes of very wet and very dry weather to become an increasingly frequent pattern as the world's climate continues to change. 85% of the wheat used for British flour is grown here in the UK. So this year's dire harvest will be bad news for millers too. Britain's millers will have to import grain to meet demand, and international wheat prices have been rising steadily. Paul Munsey runs Wessex Mill, which mills flour in Oxfordshire.
It means that we're going to have to put flour prices up. The price of wheat has gone up over the last 6 months, and now it's reached the point where we can't afford to keep selling flour at the price that we are.
Wessex Mill has already increased the price of its flour by 12%. And there is another worry. If there's a no-deal Brexit, it could mean a $107 a tonne tariff to pay on imported wheat. That would represent another more than 20% increase in the price of wheat, which once again is likely to push up the price of flour. And when the price of flour goes up, you can expect the price of bread to rise a little bit too. Not to mention biscuits, pastries and cakes. Agata Topic runs the Marco Polo Bakery with her husband Peter.
Flour is our main ingredient, but not the only, and all the prices are increasing at the moment. So that will probably force us to put our prices up.
And how do you feel about putting your prices up?
Oh, we're never happy about it. Over those 10 years, we only done it once by 10%. So we will be really sad to do that.
The first batch of bread of the night is ready. The worry is that unless we can find ways of adapting to the new weather patterns climate change is bringing, it won't just be this year that flour and bread is more expensive. In the south of England, I'm the BBC's Justin Rowlatt for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, saw this in the Wall Street Journal today, an item about office occupancy as this pandemic plods through its seventh month. Overall, and this data is from a company called Brivo, they do access control systems, key cards and stuff. They say the number of people going into offices and workplaces, which they can tell, right, because they are activating those door locks, it was, as of late August, still off 51% from where it was in February. Yes, regional variations and industry variations as well. But overall, the headline here, offices and workplaces are still basically half empty. All right, we are going, but not without your Thursday moment of economic context, just because we talked real estate with Vivian Geller up earlier in the program. Notwithstanding all that demand that she was talking about, overall residential construction notched down a bit in August, off 5.1%. But as always, you got to read the fine print. Most of that decline was in apartment construction. Multifamily is the lingo. Single family home starts were actually up a little bit more than 4%. Amir Bibawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Kat Green, and Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is 8 p.m.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.